Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
How Otto Warmbier Made It Out of North Korea by Mash Jenkins. 17 months ago, just after dawn on January 2, 2016, 21-year-old University of Virginia undergrad Otto Warmbier arrived at the airport in Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. He had spent 5 days on an organized tour of the authoritarian state with a group called Young Pioneer Tours, which advertises its destinations as places your mother would rather you stayed away from. He was slated to fly from Pyongyang to Beijing and then down to Hong Kong, where he would meet his classmates, but he never arrived. As Warmbier was checking into his flight, he was led away by 2 North Korean officials. On board the plane, a North Korean official told one of his tour guides that Warmbier was very sick and had been taken to the hospital, and that he would be released tomorrow or next week. He had not been taken to the hospital. He had been arrested for allegedly trying to steal a propaganda poster from the Pyongyang hotel where his group was staying, which in the eyes of the totalitarian North Korean legal system constituted a hostile act against North Korea. In a televised confession several weeks after his arrest, he tearfully admitted to trying to bring down the foundation of North Korea's single-minded unity. Experts believe the confession was written for him. He was sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. On Tuesday night, after a year and a half, Warmbier arrived home in Ohio. He returned to the U.S. in a coma, or so North Korean authorities told U.S. diplomats when his release was negotiated in the last 2 weeks. U.S. authorities have not confirmed his condition. In any event, his is a troubling, perplexing story, the latest grim chapter in the history of U.S.-North Korea relations, which have grown increasingly tense in recent months. Warmbier was one of 5,000 Westerners who travel to North Korea each year on structured tour programs closely monitored by North Korean authorities. Tourism brings up to $43.6 million each year, an increasingly crucial sum as the country's economy continues to suffocate under international sanctions. He landed in Pyongyang on December 29, 2015, and spent the following days sightseeing with his group. They spent New Year's Eve in Pyongyang, drinking and watching fireworks in Kim Il-sung Square, before returning to the Yonggakdo International Tourist Hotel, a lodge for foreign visitors situated on a small island on the capital's Taedong River. Gareth Johnson, Young Pioneer's managing director, declined to comment to Time on Wednesday morning in the interests of their privacy and the well-being of Otto. No one on Warmbier's tour can confirm that he did sneak off to a restricted staff-only floor of the hotel, as North Korean authorities later alleged. Otto wasn't problematic or politically outspoken, one member of his tour told Time in April. He acted like a normal 21-year-old on holiday. To be honest, if I had to pick a tourist in that group to be involved in an incident, he would have been at the bottom of the list. Many see him as a victim of circumstance, or rather of bad timing. The day before Warmbier's arrest, in a New Year's Day address to his subjects, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that the country was prepared for a merciless holy war if North Korea was provoked by invasive foreign parties. 5 days later, the country conducted its 4th nuclear weapons test, one of several acts of provocation since the 33-year-old Kim took office after his father Kim Jong-il's death in December 2011. If the U.S. was going to respond aggressively to such actions, it helps North Korea to have a bargaining chip. Shortly before Warmbier's sentencing in March 2016, his case came to the attention of Bill Richardson, the former governor and congressman from New Mexico, who also served as President Bill Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations. Since leaving public life, Richardson has worked to negotiate the release of American prisoners and hostages in North Korea and elsewhere. In the weeks after North Korea's 5th nuclear test on September 9th, Richardson's diplomatic initiative, the Richardson Center for Global Engagement, quietly sent a delegation to North Korea to discuss, among other things, the possibility of Warmbier's release. But on official diplomatic channels, there was apparent radio silence. And until very recently, Warmbier's future seemed bleak. This April, tensions between the U.S. and North Korea escalated to the highest level since the Korean War, after it was reported that Pyongyang was preparing for another nuclear test. It was the early days of President Donald Trump's presidency, and experts were unsure how the famously truculent leader would confront the situation. That month, Otto's parents, Fred and Cindy Warmbier, sat down with Tucker Carlson on Fox News to lament the fact that neither administration, Obama's or Trump's, had done much to reassure them that their son would be released. The Warmbiers have politely declined to comment to Time on several occasions. But new reports suggest that behind closed doors, Trump's State Department was working to free Warmbier. According to the testament of a State Department official given to CNN, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was instructed in February to secure the release of all American hostages in North Korea. Last month, a group of U.S. diplomats and experts, among them the State Department's special envoy to North Korea, Joseph Y. Yun, traveled to Oslo, Norway, for a series of informal talks with North Korean officials. It was decided there that Swedish diplomats in Pyongyang would be granted access to the four Americans currently in North Korean custody, according to news reports. On June 6th, 2 weeks after what would have been Warmbier's graduation from the University of Virginia, Yun received an urgent request for a meeting with Park Kil-young, North Korea's representative to the United Nations in New York, according to the Washington Post. Yun was told that Warmbier had been in a coma for more than a year. He had allegedly contracted botulism shortly after his trial and been given a sleeping pill. After that, he reportedly never woke up. In the days that followed, Tillerson met with Trump and then instructed Yun to travel to North Korea to secure Warmbier's release on humanitarian grounds, according to CNN. The delegation arrived in North Korea 2 days ago, on June 12th, and Warmbier was medically evacuated from the country on the evening of June 13th. The medical convoy landed in Cincinnati around 10:15 p.m. local time. The Post reports that he was taken from the plane with a shaved head and a tube in his nose. He was then taken by ambulance to a local hospital where he will receive treatment. There are now more questions than answers. The North Koreans have a lot of explaining to do. They may have violated the Geneva Convention, Bill Richardson said to Time in a phone call on Tuesday. It depends on Otto's condition and what the North Koreans say about what happened. But if Otto is in a coma or damaged, there will be pressure on the Trump administration to act.
Scenes from the massive West London high-rise fire. Londoners watched in shock as a 27-floor residential tower was transformed into an urban inferno early Wednesday. Flames engulfed the Grenfell Tower in West London's North Kensington neighborhood starting at around 1 a.m. local time, and the high-rise apartment complex continued to burn for more than 4 hours. The Associated Press reports that 45 fire engines and more than 200 firefighters rushed to the scene to respond. At least 30 people were taken to hospitals, according to the London Ambulance Service, amid fears that others may have been trapped inside. The city's mayor, Sadiq Khan, said on Twitter that the blaze was being treated as a major incident. Emergency responders were still on the scene. London Fire Brigade Commissioner Danny Cotton confirmed at a televised press conference that there were a number of fatalities, but the death toll is still unclear. The cause of the fire is still unknown.
Meet the couple who got married in virtual reality by Ashley Hoffman. Weddings are increasingly high-tech affairs, with everything from homemade photo booths to LED lights to drones getting in on the nuptials. But one recent ceremony might go down in wedding history as a real sign of the times. Elisa Evans, 46, and Martin Shervington, 44, got married in a futuristic dance hall underneath a glittery disco ball as red lava filled the skies overhead. At least, that's how their virtual reality wedding took place on May 25th. Modern and relatively affordable virtual reality technology made the novel approach possible for the Cardiff, Wales couple, who say they wanted something personal. Who wouldn't want to be a time-traveling robot with the opportunity to revisit their own wedding? The choice seemed the only way to go, Martin, a writer, told Time. The pair decided to partner with VR company Altspace VR to make the red lava-filled wedding of their dreams happen. They spent $2,531 apiece on the computer and headset. When it was time for their first waltz as man and wife, this never-more-hip couple in headsets swung their arms and danced at the Cardiff Cafe bar Sunflower and I. But the 40 guests at the groom's apartment passing the VR headsets around just saw two digital avatars busting a move, one royal blue and the other hot pink. Two particularly early adopters had the first cyberspace wedding when virtual reality was a much more rudimentary concept in 1994. But they couldn't move their hands around their virtual world quite like the Wales couple could, thanks to modern high-tech controllers. Not everyone knew how the mind-bending plan would come together until the wedding day. Some people were expecting us to be dressed up like robots and didn't quite understand that we were the avatars, Martin said. The guests had avatars, too. They watched as the groom played host with a heartfelt presentation peppered with jokes. As he got down to thank yous in between funny clips from The Office and Inception, the modern setup gave guests a way to get in on the action remotely. Emoji. Streams of hearts and clapping hands bubbled up from the guests' avatars within the experience. The pair fell in love with each other's humor 1 year ago, and these two have been laughing a lot since. "When you know it's right," Lisa, a business owner, said. The community manager for the company, Lisa Kotecki, beamed in from San Francisco to officiate the legally binding affair. Martin's vows, "I promise to keep on loving you, make you laugh at silly things, and allow you to be free to be yourself," he said as his avatar swiveled to face hers. Lisa's, "I promise to love you, to make you happy, and to laugh with you every day. I promise to try not to be funnier than you," she answered. "That's going to be difficult," he added. The playful ceremony went off mostly without a hitch, though the kiss was tricky with the bulky equipment on their heads. Lucky for them, there was another chance. In real life, the kiss was fine, Martin said. Skeptics questioning the whole practice will be happy to know the cutting-edge wedding didn't totally replace the real thing. After guests sent the couple off in style by streaming neon purple firework-like animated interactables into the venue using glow sticks, it was time for guests to leave the groom's apartment and join the couple at the cafe bar across the street, Sunflower and I. The affair was structured to reflect the virtual reality experience, right down to the bride's walk down the aisle to Hamburg Song by Keen and the Beatles classic All You Need Is Love. The party, however, had food. Along with some FaceTime, guests enjoyed a custom cake with toppers they recognized, mini pink and blue robots. But the most interesting difference between the simulated event and the one they had for real may have been the emotional landscape. "We didn't get to see a sea of heart emojis from the guests in the real world, but there were a lot of smiles," Martin said. The now popular 360-degree wedding video is one way to immortalize the memories, but this next-level couple can throw on a headset and relive their special day whenever they want. That's not even what invigorates them most. "Marriage is in the heart," Martin said. "We have the memory of getting married in parallel, virtual and real world, in our minds."
This is the age when you become old, according to four different generations. By Carrie Ann Renzulli. If age really is just a number, what number marks old age? Well, the answer to that depends on how old you are now. Millennials hold the least generous views on aging, saying that you're old beginning at just 59, according to a new study by U.S. Trust. Older groups, however, put the starting point further out. Gen X, on average, bumps the beginning of old age to 65, while boomers and the silent generation both agreed that age 73 is the start. Here's how different groups defined old and young according to the 2017 U.S. Trust Insights on Wealth and Worth report. The survey of more than 800 high-net-worth households defined millennials as being between the ages of 21 and 36, Gen X 37 to 52, boomers 53 to 72, and the silent generation anyone 73 or older. Surprisingly, millennials were the most inclusive when it came to defining who is young, saying that only at age 40 does youth end. Of course, this means they think middle age spans only 19 years. Gen X and boomers see people growing up quite a bit faster. Both groups, on average, say youth ends at 31, while the silent generation was more lenient, bumping the figure up to 35.
asked separately to define the age at which someone hits the prime of life in terms of a person's resources, potential, capacity, and influence, millennials put that at 36. Older respondents, all already past 36 themselves, felt the prime of life came later. Gen X said age 47 was the prime, while boomers put it at 50, and the silent generation selected age 52 as best. For another view, the Japan Gerontological Society and Japan Geriatric Society released a study earlier this year that concluded the term old best applies to those between the ages of 75 and 89. People 65 to 74 could be thought of as pre-old, while those age 90 and over earn the title super old, they said. Negative opinions about aging can be a significant impediment to older workers who are looking to find new jobs or advance in their careers. That's a particular problem as longer lifespans and savings shortfalls have many people looking to delay retirement or work part-time after they shop full-time work. One piece of good news, AARP has demonstrated that young people's sense of what age is old can be changed pretty easily. As part of its Disrupt Aging campaign, the group questioned millennials on what age was old and then introduced them to people who were the ages they named. In an entertaining video, you can see how the youths all changed their answers to a much later age because none of the people met the millennials' expectations of what an old person should look, act, or sound like. The signs they were expecting to see? Illness, memory loss, difficulty walking, and struggles with technology. Meanwhile, a study by Pew Research Center several years ago found that many of the markers we associate with aging, including illness, memory loss, and an end to sexual activity, are experienced by fewer older adults than younger adults think. In the end, maybe we should just take comfort in the fact that age really is just a number, and that what we think of as old now may in fact not be that old. How I Became a Better Father by Writing a Book by Val Emick. I watched her little leaning body, puffed up in a pink winter coat, tip over and out of the shopping cart, her head striking the concrete first. The rest of her settled on the floor of Home Depot. She was 20 months old. My daughter, Harper. For a moment, I just stood over her, staring, waiting, frozen in panic. She was only lying there, not crying, not doing anything. I scooped her up and ran out of the store. In the car, I called my sister, a nurse. She asked questions, and I answered them. Yes, she's awake. Yes, she's responding to me. No, I didn't strap her into the shopping cart with the seatbelt. I forgot. What the hell was wrong with me? Whose bright idea was it to let me be a parent? Why was my wife leaving our baby in my sole custody 5 days a week while she was at work? It would have made more sense for us to switch places. She actually wanted to be home, while I would have preferred to be anywhere else, out touring with my band, acting on a TV show, sitting in a coffee shop generating ideas for a novel. But instead, I was at Home Depot shopping for mousetraps and shower caulk with my kid. I wasn't ready to be a father. I wasn't ready to be a husband either, or a homeowner. My wife has always been the one in our relationship actively and confidently pushing us to the next step on our shared journey while I sit back and let it happen, the same way I let my daughter fall. In the end, Harper was completely okay. I wish I'd known then what I know now, that kids are extremely durable and always this close to being permanently ripped from your life. I've spoken to dozens of other parents who've shared similar nightmarish stories about their children, tales of fear and anguish and shame that all somehow end happily. But at the time, I lacked the comfort of wisdom and perspective. I was shaken. Shaken in addition to what I already felt, disengaged, frustrated, resentful, bored, all because I'd been forced into a domestic role I stunk at. I was a pathetic case, far from the type of father a child deserves. I knew something had to change. Perhaps that's why I ended up doing what I did. One day, during one of Harper's naps, I started writing a story in the voice of a little girl. I'd never attempted this sort of thing before, stepping into the perspective of someone like Harper. This girl was the opposite of me. A ball of sunshine, energetic, optimistic, unstoppable. I hadn't experienced anything as pure fun in a long time, but that's what it was, seeing the world through her eyes. Fun. For the next few weeks, I kept writing. There was something contagious about this little girl, and I wanted to spend as much time inside her head as I could. I'd wake up early in the morning and write for a few hours while Harper was still sleeping. When it came time to begin my parental duties, I arrived with a sense of accomplishment and greater confidence. Instead of daydreaming ways to escape my reality, I'd found a way to access and embrace it. Harper doesn't like when I talk about the time she fell in Home Depot. She wouldn't even recall the event if it weren't for me always bringing it up. I don't do it to torture her or myself. For me, it's an important reminder. I made a terrible, horrible mistake, but grew from it. The episode was one of the worst moments in my life, yet it made me a better father. I have two daughters now, and they're the force pushing me forward. As much as raising children has driven me to grow up, it's also rekindled the playfulness, curiosity, and empathy in me that had long been dormant. Yes, I'm more careful now when it comes to sensing and avoiding danger, but I'm also stronger in my responses to setbacks and stumbles. We fall, we get up, we fall again. It's okay, I can say to my kids, and mean it. Val Emick is the author of The Reminders, published by Little Brown. Why Wildlife Photography Matters in a Post-Truth Era, by Alexandra Genova. When the term alternative facts was coined, scientists, climate change campaigners, and anyone with an interest in preserving the planet took a collective sigh of despair. For the post-truth era is not just damaging for political integrity, it threatens the survival of biodiversity as we know it. So what can the experts fight with when they can't fight with facts? We go back to the pictures, veteran wildlife photographer Nick Nichols tells Time. So as long as we're in this cycle of lies, the pictures can actually stand up again and do some more work. I still believe that photography plays, I hate to say it this way, unfortunately, the strongest role, because data and science doesn't necessarily hit you emotionally. Nichols has carved out a 40-year career by making photographs as muscularly powerful as the gorillas and lions he documents. They artfully and honestly force the viewer to understand the meaning of wild and why it must be protected. His 27 stories for National Geographic have variously heightened the public consciousness on subjects including old-growth redwoods, the world's remaining tigers, and the emotional relationship of the elephant family. All sought to turn up the heat on conservation efforts using effective imagery. I'm looking for intimacy and energy, says Nichols, whose biography A Wild Life, published by Aperture and written by Melissa Harris, is out now. Because you're not going to capture anybody's imagination with boring pictures. It's that simple. And that's kind of my personality. So it was a good fit. The Alabama native, now 64, grew up in a broken home. His father was a functional alcoholic who left when he was 3, and his mother was a binge alcoholic who raised 3 kids in poverty with a 4th-grade education. I started living in a fantasy world, reading John Carter and Edgar Rice Burroughs. I used to escape into what we call the woods, says Nichols, and that's just a couple of acres of plot behind the house in Alabama, but it became as big as the African rainforest. Without realizing it, he was training himself to survive in tough climates. Where some people are not comfortable, the jungle of Congo became just like a home to me, he says. Even though the swamps you walk in with your sandals have snakes and crocodiles, you don't focus on that. You focus on, well, I'm here to get pictures, so it doesn't matter. Nichols had malaria 25 times before he was 35 years old and languished in countless remote hospitals with other life-threatening illnesses. But, he says, he's much more at ease in the wilderness where there are what he calls predictable violence. He adds, I literally loved being in a place that drove most people crazy when they go here. Nichols ultimately used this talent for physical detachment to give a voice to the voiceless. I got there through the animals teaching me and Jane Goodall teaching me, he says. I didn't want to just jump from one assignment to the next. I wanted everything to be cumulative. And once I did the gorillas, begun in 1981, early in my life, I thought, wow, I can be a voice for them. They need somebody like me. Instead of devoting my talents to illustrative stories in Rolling Stone, you can be lucky enough to fool yourself into thinking you have a cause. His cause has resulted in 4 decades of highly impactful reportage. In 1999, Nichols joined Nat Geo explorer Michael Fay on an arduous 2,000-mile trek from the Congo in Central Africa to Gabon. He joined Fay at 5 points along the journey for 2 to 3 weeks at a time, and it was here that Nichols took the now iconic image of hippopotamuses swimming in the Atlantic Ocean, an astonishing poetic sight that few had seen before. The picture and the accompanying body of work on Central Africa led Gabon President Omar Bongo to create a system of 13 national parks that now cover 11% of the country. The pictures were also used by conservationists to secure the expansion of a national park in the Central African Republic. For good reason, surfing hippos was named one of Time's most influential images of all time. The project, which Nichols says is his most substantial work, also served to crystallize what is at the heart of all conservation efforts, land. Although we focus on megafauna, you focus on tigers or grizzly bears or elephants or spotted owls because they're the hook, all that matters in conservation really is land, says Nichols. Even with our deluge of images, people still are moved by imagery. And then let someone else follow me with substance. That's why I work so much with really solid scientists. To that end, Nichols is more a photojournalist than a wildlife photographer, though he admits he made mistakes in his earlier career, manipulating situations to further the picture. He comes from a journalism background and learned how to respect the truth of the wild. I did do some things in my career where I was ashamed of pushing my subject too hard, he says. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm not going to do that. When I decided that, my subjects always gave me what I needed. He learned to live by the old Rolling Stones adage, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need. The ethical quagmire of genuine wildlife photography reflects the difficult truth of how humans really want to coexist with wild animals. The bottom line is humans like wildlife, he says, but we don't really want it to be wild. We want it to be pretty much packaged and safe. We don't want a wolf to kill our dogs, and we don't want a mountain lion to kill our cat. In contrast, the wild that Nichols sought wasn't tidy and sometimes wasn't palatable. We want cute and cuddly tigers and lions, but they're much better off when they're wild and savage and driven by their instincts, he says. There is no morality in the natural world. A male lion will kill cubs so the female will breed with him the next day and have his cubs. To respect this natural order is to respect the ability of the natural world to balance itself out without human intervention. Indeed, if Nichols has one thing to share with eager photojournalists who follow him, it is this. As a young photographer, I was driven to succeed and to satisfy my client or my desire, he says. But over time, I just became very relaxed about failing. And I didn't fail because I just stayed at it. So you can just let it come to you, and then when you do that, it's better. It's just simply better. And that's the great lesson to share, is to let it happen. When Nichols announced he was bowing out of the game, his colleagues freaked out. His incredible stamina and brazen disregard for what his body could sustain made him seem superhuman. He's been a constant for many people throughout their careers. But he says he just doesn't have anything left to do with the camera. I just wanted to stay on point the whole time, he says, and so that's why I'm spent because I used it all up. Now Nichols sees his roles shifting. He believes his job is to make a difference with his archive. I will use what I've learned to be a senior citizen for the wild, he says. There's no doubt that Nichols has taken some of the most iconic wildlife photographs of this century. but he alone knows the photographs he didn't take. You can't depend on photography. You go out and you try and you stay focused, but in the end, there's something higher, he says. In the end, I got what I had to get, but boy, what I didn't get, the things I've seen that I couldn't capture or didn't translate, because when you commit to still photography, you are committing to a moment. Nichols' skill at distilling a complex struggle for survival into a single moment made him a valuable tool in conservation efforts, a fight he will continue even after he puts the camera down. Even with this great divide we're in right now, I'm convinced that we're going to come out of it better, says Nichols. It's about being honorable, because I believe that we can get it right before the end of the game. I pray for that. If you're in my position, you can't think about the other side. You just keep fighting. And I fight with images. Michael Nick Nichols is an award-winning photographer who worked on staff for National Geographic and became their editor-at-large for photography in 2008. He was also a member of Magnum Photos from 1982 to 1995. His biography, A Wild Life, is written by Melissa Harris and published by Aperture. An exhibition of Nichols' work, Wild, Michael Nichols, will be on display at the Philadelphia Museum of Art from June 27th to September 17th.
I'm even better than Elizabeth Taylor. Meet Chinese actress Liu Zhaojing, by Charlie Campbell. I said to President Obama, I'm the best ever actress in the East, even better than Elizabeth Taylor, Liu Zhaojing says matter-of-factly. He just replied, yes, yes indeed. In the pantheon of great Chinese actresses, few names come as revered as Liu. The star of more than 60 films and TV shows, Madam Liu, as she likes to be called, has a resume that includes 4 marriages, once being China's richest woman, and a jail term for tax evasion. Now 61 years young, she's keen to discuss her latest role over dinner at Beijing's Four Seasons Hotel. It's a role she's already played 4 times over. The tale of Empress Wu is like jade, she tells Time, dressed in a black tee bearing the slogan Little Cutie over a green military-style shirt. We're on a treasure hunt for this most precious of treasures, unraveling the mysteries of that period and person. That person is Wu Zetian, the only woman to have ever ruled China, and that period is the Tang Dynasty, AD 618 to 906. Liu is due to reprise the role in a 14-part series entitled Empress, due to hit American screens late next year. Empress Wu is legendary in China for using her wit, intelligence, and cunning to eclipse all rivals and rise from her position as Emperor Taizong's favorite concubine to the very apex of court life. She also had scores of lovers, ruled through 72 prime ministers, and is believed to have killed her own daughter. Only after I acted as Empress Wu did people start thinking positive things about her, says Liu. That's evidently why Peter Luo, the CEO of Chinese movie company Starlight Films, asked Liu to rekindle the role in his new production. Game of Thrones executive producer Christopher Newman has signed on to the project, Luo says, and he's eyeing a leading, most cutting-edge director for the first season, tossing out names like Roland Emmerich of Independence Day fame. Whoever is chosen, they have to be the very best of the best, says Luo. The show could even expand over 5, 10, or more than 10 seasons. Those are big ambitions for a project without a broadcasting deal. Still, Luo doesn't seem phased. Once when we finalize the script and the cast, we will finally negotiate with HBO, he says. We have them in mind because we have a production team pretty much from Game of Thrones. It becomes clear over the conversation that Starlight plans to adapt the Empress Wu story to produce a Chinese equivalent of Game of Thrones, winner of a record 38 Emmys and maker of hundreds of millions of dollars for its network. The timing may be right. There will be a Seven Kingdom-sized hole in American viewing schedules after the 8th and final season of the fantasy drama airs, possibly as early as next year. Could the Middle Kingdom fill it? Liu is adamant, stressing that Empress will not be a cheap knockoff. I've watched every episode of Game of Thrones, and I've every confidence that we'll beat them in every possible way, she says. Otherwise, there will be no point in expending so much energy. Having watched the series so exhaustively, she must have a favorite character. All of them, Liu answers magnanimously. Born in the southwestern province of Sichuan shortly after Mao Zedong declared the establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949, Liu always dreamed of stardom, but she came of age during the tumultuous Cultural Revolution, 1966 to 1976, when plays and films, besides those made for propaganda, were banned as bourgeois vanities. After toiling as a farmhand and a railways worker, Liu spent 10 years in the army, where she finally managed to break through as a propaganda performer, earning around $10 a month. "I couldn't support my family," she says. But China began opening up in the late 1970s, and Liu quickly established herself as a leading name in a resurgent film and television industry. With her name and her earnings, she was able to start businesses in real estate, beverages, alcohol, apparel, cosmetics, and household appliances. In 1999, she appeared at number 45 on Forbes' list of the 50 richest people in China and was the highest-placed woman. But 3 years later came the tax evasion conviction and a year and 2 months in Beijing's notorious Qincheng jail. "When I went in, I was the boss and didn't even know how to open a door for myself," she says. It was a tough time of bad food and cold showers, enlivened only by the odd game of badminton with prison wardens. Liu had to sleep with up to 7 other inmates on the floor of a small cell. "I used to jog diagonally across the cell, and the other inmates had to stand against the wall to give me enough space," she says. After her release, Liu had nothing, only debts, she says. "I used to walk around Beijing and say, 'I used to own this house and this house and this house.'" Despite her celebrity, she could only secure roles as a non-speaking extra, earning $5 or $10 a day. Eventually, though, better work started arriving. "I was such a wonderful actress that I earned the respect of everyone who met me." Today, Liu may not have riches of old, but she's happy being comfortable. Empress Wu, of course, suffered her own tribulations. She was dispatched to a nunnery upon the death of her husband, Emperor Taizong, and like Liu, hauled herself back to glory through guile and determination. She won the heart of the new emperor, Gaozong, dispatched rivals using fleet-footed assassins, but importantly built a following among the common people through wise governance and meritocracy. Strong female characters like the Empress remain in short supply in Chinese politics, however. Mao might have enthused that women hold up half the sky, but there are no female faces in the upper echelons of today's ruling Communist Party. In fact, China has only one female provincial governor and one female provincial party secretary. Women make up less than a quarter of China's National People's Congress, the nation's rubber-stamp legislature, and are poorly represented in boardrooms, too. Oddly, Liu doesn't seem to mind. "It's the choice of women," she says. "Maybe women are not so pushy and attracted to politics." Besides, her affinity for the character lies on a far more mystical plane. When the Empress production team visited Empress Wu's tomb in China's ancient walled city of Xi'an, there was a very beautiful rolling cloud with a silver tint, and the local people said it was a miracle because their empress had returned, Liu says. "And a Buddha's halo followed me wherever I went."
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.